Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When we listen on Audible, we are unconfined, free to travel the worlds inside our minds, where time moves faster, stops, rewinds. So let's walk and dance a mile in other shoes. Whatever's next is ours to choose. There's more to imagine when we listen. Audiobooks, podcasts, originals. Start listening now at Audible.
When you buy a Tim's coffee on camp day, 100% of the proceeds will help send youth to a multi-year, life-changing experience. Only on July 19th, buy a Tim's coffee and help change youth's lives.
Where can you hear all the latest from the Women's World Cup in Australia and New Zealand?
Some big players, they're electric going forward.
World football at the Women's World Cup from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Chris Berrow, and at 13 GMT on Tuesday the 18th of July, these are our main stories. The authorities in China accidentally published cremation figures that could be linked to a spike in COVID deaths. One of Ukraine's senior military commanders admits his frustration at the speed of their counteroffensive. And,
frankly, $6 to $7 billion for a 12-day sporting event, we are not doing that. That does not represent value for money. That is all cost and no benefit.
The Commonwealth Games is looking for a new home after the planned hosts pull out. Also in this podcast, temperatures hit record highs on both sides of the Atlantic and why one child protection charity is urging a rethink on AI-generated imagery. It was an oversight by the authorities in the Chinese province of Zhejiang. They published cremation figures from the beginning of this year and they show a big increase on the numbers from a year ago. The online figures were taken down quickly, but now questions are being asked about an increase in COVID deaths. Our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Michael Bristow, told us why these figures matter.
We just don't know how many people have died of COVID in China. The Chinese government gave us some figures from the beginning of this year suggesting 80,000 had died. But since then, there have been no statistics at all. The Chinese government has even covered up and not released the number of people who have been cremated, which, if that had increased, it would have given us an indication of the number of people who might have died from COVID. So that's why these figures from this one province are important, because it gives us a little window into what was been going on in China as relates to COVID, and it shows that the number of cremations increased by 72%, many tens of thousands, suggesting that a lot of people have died of COVID.
Can you make that interpretation realistically? Is it very likely that that's the cause? Because it could be other factors, temperature, for example.
It could be, and it's impossible to say that all the excess cremations, all the excess deaths are related to COVID. It's equally difficult to extrapolate that information use it to estimate a nationwide figure. Zhejiang province is home to just 5% of the Chinese population. There are a number of differences in the people who live there compared to other places. So it's very, very difficult to use this Zhejiang figure and extend it across the country. But as I said, it does give you an indication that there was a rise in the number of cremations, a significant rise, at a time when COVID was sweeping through China.
And why doesn't the Chinese government just come out and say, these are the number of COVID deaths, here are the statistics? Why not?
It tries to control the narrative. For the first few years of the pandemic, it said it had successfully, through its zero COVID policies, kept COVID at bay. And then late last year, when it suddenly dropped those policies and COVID swept through the nation, it still tried to hide the number of people who were actually dying. In fact, in February, it declared what it called a decisive victory against COVID. In the meantime, we don't know how many people have died. The World Health Organization doesn't. Chinese people don't know how many people have died. They want to control the narrative, the Chinese government, so they don't want people to know the numbers.
Well, John Sudworth is the BBC's former China correspondent and now hosts a podcast called Fever, The Hunt for COVID's Origin. He told me that years after the disease came to light, we still can't be sure where it came from.
This is an eight-part series. It's an in-depth look into the question of COVID's origin. And I think those listeners who've stuck with us all the way will have, understood a number of key things. The first thing, overshadowing that question, and all of the wider issues around COVID, where it came from, the initial outbreak, the handling of it, overshadowing all of that is the question of the lack of transparency in terms of China's response. And I think those people who have looked, as we have, and followed us through the scientific debate, the political discussion over the question of COVID's origin in particular, will have a very strong sense that, really the defining issue here isn't a question of how much we do know and weighing up sort of different versions of the evidence, but it's really how little we know. More than 3 years on, almost everybody now agrees that question, the lack of transparency, is really the defining issue and explains how it is that so long after this outbreak, we still are unable really to come up with any sort of definitive answers as to where this thing came from.
John Sudworth. The Commonwealth Games is a 12-day sporting event involving thousands of athletes from more than 70 countries and territories. The competition takes place every 4 years and was next due to take place in 2026. But its future hangs in the balance after the Australian state of Victoria pulled out of hosting earlier today. Its Premier Dan Andrews said it was too expensive.
Look, I've made a lot of difficult calls, a lot of very difficult decisions in this job. This is not one of them. Frankly, $6 to $7 billion for a 12-day sporting event, we are not doing that. That does not represent value for money. That is all cost and no benefit. The Games will not proceed in Victoria in 2026. We have informed Commonwealth Games authorities of our decision to seek to terminate the contract.
Our sports correspondent Alex Capstick told us more.
You've just heard from the Victoria Premier, Daniel Andrews. He didn't mince his words earlier. He said he was happy to help out, but not at any price. He certainly doesn't think that the costs involved here are value for money. Just to remind you, $1.7 billion was the estimated budget for this event in Victoria, the Commonwealth Games. That's risen to over $4 billion. Dan Andrews is not sure that's going to be enough, and he'd rather spend the money on public services like schools and hospitals. Nevertheless, this has come as a big surprise. Many people pointing to the fact that the local government had decided to stage the event in regional cities, building new sports facilities in five or six regional centres rather than using existing sporting infrastructure in Melbourne. Lots of very fine sports stadium in that Australian city, and that may be one reason why the costs have spiralled. But certainly it's a big blow for the Commonwealth Games Federation, who described it as deeply disappointing.
And does that mean, in your view, that it could be the end of the Commonwealth Games full stop? Because I know that Victoria only stepped in because no one else was interested at that time.
Yeah, they did. That was a bidding process hampered by a lack of bidders. And it's not the first time this has happened. Birmingham stepped in. Birmingham hosted last year's event at the last minute when Durban in South Africa pulled out of hosting the Games. The government refused to fund it or make funds available for extra building that was needed in the South African city. And you look at other cities that have pulled out of the bidding process. It's a long old list that includes Cardiff, Edmonton, Adelaide, Kuala Lumpur, you know, a lot of cities thinking or deciding that it's just not worth the effort. And it just highlight the burden on local cities of hosting such major mega sports events. And whether this is the end of the Commonwealth Games, well, you know, we'll have to see. The Commonwealth Games Federation have already said admitted that they were trying to become more relevant, to modernise. They've reduced the number of sports in the Games. And there was a sense that they were struggling to attract or make it an attractive option to host the Games. And I think over the next sort of months or years, and we'll see if any of the cities are able to step in a bid or want to host the Games. And if it doesn't happen, I think you have to actually question whether there will be another Commonwealth Games.
Alex Capstick. And staying with sport, as part of a series on the Women's World Cup, the BBC's Business Daily programme has been looking into why Australia and New Zealand were chosen to host the tournament together and the facilities that will be available to teams and fans when it kicks off on Thursday. Presenter Sam Fenwick spoke to cafe owner Nigel Cottle in New Zealand about how his business will cope with the influx of people.
We're in the neighbourhood of Morningside, which is in sort of the suburbs of central Auckland. And we're right next to Eden Park. We're about a 5-minute walk from Eden Park.
And it will host the opening ceremony of the Women's World Cup.
That's pretty great, isn't it? Yeah, we're stoked about that.
Nigel Cottle is the owner of a cafe called Crave. He employs around 35 people, and he's really excited to be so close to the action.
This is going to be the biggest sporting event New Zealand's ever seen. And, you know, 10 years ago, no one would have thought a women's sporting event would be the biggest sporting event.
I was just wondering if you'd worked out, you know, what you anticipate making in terms of revenue over that kind of 4-week period of the Games.
The question is, if we get busier and it's all just food and coffee, we've got to kind of increase our manufacturing capability in the moment. But if it's, say, a bigger drinking culture, then you can kind of make more money with a smaller crew of people. It's easier. So there's just that sense of we don't know how that's going to work and whether we're going to have to gear up from a busyness from a like making coffee and food perspective, or if it's going to be the other way around. So my expectation is just a bit of both, and I reckon we might see about a 20-30% bump overall.
But the hospitality industry in Australia is still suffering from a post-pandemic hangover. Since closing its borders during COVID, the country has struggled to find enough skilled and unskilled workers to fill jobs and drive the economy. Restaurants, cafes and bars are struggling the most. Wages are up by a quarter in a year, and on average, servers get around $25 an hour. Some businesses are offering generous sign-on bonuses and perks like half-price food and drinks to try and entice people to work for them. Suresh Manikam from Australia's Restaurant and Catering Industry Association says the added costs are a real struggle for his members.
Our costs are actually fairly high. The inflation is continuing to go up, so that is reflected in almost everything that we've got here. And one of those, of course, is food and restaurants. Staffing is a very big challenge for us and continues to be a challenge for us. In fact, we haven't really recovered to our staffing levels that were pre-pandemic. And that is really a function of the skills shortage that we are finding ourselves in Australia. It is also a function of the fact that we just haven't returned to those migration levels that you would ordinarily expect some jobs to be drawn from. So we have, for instance, student visas, we have people coming here on working visas and the like. So unfortunately, the skill crisis will continue.
Are you trying to kind of tap into people on short-term visas or people at university to temporarily work during the period of the World Cup?
We are certainly talking to the federal government about relaxing some of those university visa conditions. That's something that we've been in discussion with the government with for a while now, and something that we would like to see occur.
Well, now let's turn our attention to Ukraine, where one of the country's most senior military commanders has admitted the counteroffensive is not going as quickly as he'd like. General Oleksandr Syrsky, who's in charge of military operations in eastern Ukraine, told the BBC that quick results were proving to be practically impossible because the Russian defences are so well prepared. But General Syrsky says he hopes Ukraine will be able to recapture the city of Bakhmut. Our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale sent this report from eastern Ukraine.
The bloody battle for Bakhmut still isn't over. The city itself is now held by the Russians. But we travelled with Ukrainian troops in an armoured vehicle toward the front line. They're now trying to take it back.
There's a drone flying over, we're trying to work it. It's a Ukrainian one.
Напружено. Ворог From his mortar position, Alex tells me the situation is tense. As you see, he says, the enemy's firing at our position.
Again? Head out!
That was a bit close.
That was a Russian shell landing. Their positions are just about 3 kilometres away from here. Last time I was near here, 2 months ago, it was the Ukrainians losing ground and in danger of being surrounded. Now it's the other way round. This is another bunker where they've got monitors showing drone feeds coming in of the ground around Bakhmut. This is open countryside we're looking at, just pockmarked fields.
This command centre, well away from the shelling, is where Ukraine's coordinating its offensive around Bakhmut. Colonel Oleksandr Bakulin admits they're suffering losses, but not on the same scale as the Russians.
We've taken the initiative. The enemy is bringing in troops and wants to escape the trap, but they're in trouble. Bakhmut could be encircled.
Ukraine is using all it can to break the Russian defences. But it will soon have a new weapon.
Ukraine artillery now occupies the high ground surrounding Bakhmut, and it is these US-supplied howitzers that will soon be using the controversial cluster munitions.
Everyone here knows, including the battery commander Serhii, that the use of cluster bombs is proving controversial.
We can use them.
And will you have any concerns about using them?
In the field, no. On the town, forbidden for this, because it's not human.
This is a Canadian vehicle. Yes. Yeah. This is a command vehicle, yes?
Yeah.
Oleksandr Sirsky is the general in charge of all military operations in the east, the mastermind behind the defence of Kyiv and the successful offensive in Kharkiv. Unlike many Russian commanders, he's lionized by his troops. And now his eyes are firmly set on retaking Bakhmut. There's a constant feed of the battle from the command vehicle he uses to visit his troops.
We would like to get very fast results, but in reality, it's practically impossible. This entire area is well prepared with defences, so all advances are not going as fast as we would like.
Most of the front remains relatively static. Ukraine has still to commit all its forces, but it's yet to break through Russia's heavily mined main lines of defence.
Jonathan Beale in eastern Ukraine. Still to come, McDonald's have questions to answer after claims of harassment from workers here in Britain.
McDonald's does 100% have a problem with sexual harassment. They'd grope stomachs, waists, bum, thighs as well, I'd say, and hips.
Giving you the lowdown on the Women's World Cup Down Under. World football at the Women's World Cup from the BBC World Service. We're in Australia and New Zealand throughout the tournament, going behind the scenes to bring you all the excitement of the competition.
This is something I've dreamed of. I love the spotlight, I love pressure, I love it all.
Listen now by searching for World Football wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now, a child protection charity is calling on Britain's Prime Minister to make the threat of AI-generated child sexual abuse imagery a priority when the UK hosts a global AI summit later this year. The Internet Watch Foundation is one of only 3 charities in the world that are licensed to actively search for child abuse content online. They specialise in finding and removing it from the web. Our cyber correspondent Joe Tidy sent this report, and I should warn listeners that it contains a description of content which some may find upsetting.
These days, anyone with a laptop can be an artist. With AI and an idea, the sky's the limit.
By typing in a few words, you can create any image that you like. So, for example, a cat holding a banana in the style of Van Gogh. Let's try that. The only real limit is your imagination, but there are some safeguards put in place. Many of these tools have banned words or phrases to stop people creating illegal or offensive imagery. But we now know that hasn't really worked.
The Internet Watch Foundation finds, removes and logs child sexual abuse material online. Their trained analysts say they're increasingly seeing content made with artificial intelligence. What have you got here,
Tamsin? So the first image I want to show you is more of a cartoony style of image of a girl on the beach. I'd say she's probably about 3 to 6 years old. These images are shocking.
Just how bad does it get?
It varies. So from kind of that style all the way up to where it's very difficult to tell the difference between that and a real image.
Last month, for the first time, the IWF started actively logging reports of AI images. Analysts discovered galleries on multiple websites, some containing Category A material, the most graphic possible. The team says predators are sharing tips on how to trick the AIs into drawing the content, and there's evidence that open-source image generators are proving popular with predators. Open-source software allows anyone to download the source code for free, with no restrictions on how they change it or adapt it.
We found a Twitter account belonging to an AI image creator who specialises in making sexualised portraits of preteen girls.
He says he's aware of the fact that his images do sexualise children, but celebrates that this is the first time in history that AI can allow him to create what he calls cute images of girls without exploiting real children. Dr. Michael Bork is the former chief psychologist for the United States Marshals Service.
There's no doubt in my mind that AI-generated images are going to increase these predilections, are going to reinforce this deviance, and it will lead to greater harm and greater risk of harm to children around the world.
So, what can be done? Well, very little, in truth. No one is in charge of Stable Diffusion or any other open-source AI generators. And as regulators around the world try to bring some control into AI companies and products, it feels like in some cases, the cat might already be out of the bag.
Joe Tidy with that report. Now, many young people in Britain begin their working lives at the fast food chain McDonald's. Around three quarters of the workforce are under the age of 25. But staff there have told the BBC of a toxic culture at the company. Allegations involve sexual harassment, bullying and racism. And this is 17-year-old Shelby, who worked in one of its restaurants in the southeast of England last year, and some listeners may find her description disturbing.
McDonald's does 100% have a problem with sexual harassment. They'd grope stomachs, waists, bum, thighs as well, I'd say, and hips. Why should we have to go to work in fear? I was just speaking to one of my friends and he just sort of grabbed me by my hips and then pulled me onto his groin area. And then he just, like, held me there. I felt disgusted. I was like, because he was so much older as well.
Zoe Conway is part of the team investigating.
My colleague Noor Nanji and I started looking at this in February, and over the last 4 months we've spoken to 100 employees. And clearly they don't speak for everyone. There are 170,000 people working for McDonald's in the UK. But what really struck us was we kept hearing the same stories over and over again. And so we feel that we detected something of a pattern, a culture at McDonald's stores. What we're talking about are very young people, as you say. People often work at McDonald's at the same time as going to college or university. It's very flexible. The pay actually is relatively quite good. And they expect it to be a fun atmosphere. So they can be as young as 16. But what we're hearing is that there's then another set of people working at the restaurant, older people, and there just doesn't seem to be enough management going on, to be quite honest. There just doesn't seem to be enough looking after these younger people, because what we're hearing is that those sometimes those older members of staff are preying on these younger people, and there just don't seem to be any boundaries in place in too many stores.
What has McDonald's said in response to some of these allegations?
They have apologise. They've said that they deeply apologise and say there are clearly instances where we've fallen short, and they're going to investigate all the allegations that we've put to them. And if there have been breaches of what they call their code of conduct, then it could result in people being dismissed. And they've also said that they have got training in place for managers when it comes to sexual harassment training, and that that's being rolled out across the country.
And we've been speaking about the UK, but there are other allegations in America.
That's right. This actually dates back a few years now. In fact, the CEO of McDonald's in Chicago back in 2019 had to step down and had to hand back $100 million in stocks and shares because he'd been having inappropriate relationships with three female colleagues. And there are now multi-million dollar lawsuits that are being brought by women in the United States. In fact, one lawsuit was settled out of court for $1.5 million. That was brought by McDonald's workers in Michigan. But there are more lawsuits that the company is facing. So this is not just a UK story. Also, the European Parliament has had a hearing about this, and they have heard from workers from France, Brazil and the United States. So this is not just about what's happening here in the UK.
Zoe Conway. The temperatures of 40 degrees Celsius are not unusual in southern Spain at the height of summer, but yesterday almost 45 degrees was registered in the town of Andújar in Andalusia, the highest temperature of the day in Europe. And it's hot elsewhere. In Sicily, 43 degrees was measured. Our correspondent in Italy, Sofia Battizza, sent this report from Palermo.
The sun in Sicily is scorching hot. The air is stifling and oppressive. Like many other cities across Italy, Palermo, the capital, has been placed under a red alert warning. That means the heat poses a threat to everybody. But it's the elderly who are most at risk. Like Totò d'Alberto, who's 70. He says he spends most days confined at home.
I'm old and I need to protect myself. Elderly people need to be careful with these temperatures. I'm at home all day long with the windows shut and the air conditioning on. I don't mind if my electricity bill goes through the roof. I cannot live with this heat.
These extreme temperatures can be dangerous. Last summer, more than 18,000 people died in Italy because of the heat. Attilio Scalisi owns a small tobacco shop in the city centre of Palermo.
This heat is causing a lot of problems. This is not a good way to live. It's very unpleasant. Blood pressure issues and heat strokes are becoming more and more frequent.
The authorities here are warning people to prepare for one of the most intense heat waves of all time. The mayor of Palermo, Roberto La Galla, is urging people to take this seriously.
We are recommending people to stay indoors during the hottest hours. We are trying to inform them about the risks for their health and providing medical assistance, especially for the elderly and small children.
Italians are used to hot summers, but not this hot, especially as the consecutive heat waves came all of a sudden. Attilio Scalisi again.
Il caldo c'è sempre stato.
Summers have always been warm, but this is abnormal. Temperatures used to rise gradually and then reach their peak in the middle of August. But now we have these sudden heat waves that last 3 or 4 days or a week with extreme temperatures, and then they drop. We were not prepared for this.
Periods of intense heat are becoming more frequent and more severe. And with this heat wave expected to continue for the next few days, there is no respite in sight.
Climate change seemed just a fantasy, like something out of a movie. But instead, it's starting to feel very real, and it's affecting our lives every day.
Well, across the Atlantic, extreme heat is also having a devastating impact. The southwest of America and South Florida are experiencing scorching temperatures, with roughly a quarter of the US population under a heat advisory, according to the National Weather Service. More than 70 million people across America have been facing dangerous levels of heat. One of them is Beverly Willard from Stockton, California.
One thing I've noticed a lot is I've been paying attention to trees, and We have had a lot of trees in our neighborhood just fall over. And you can see from their roots, especially if they were like in a grassy area, they had rather shallow roots. But some of these trees had trunks quite expansive, maybe 3 feet in diameter. So that was flabbergasting to see those kinds of things happen. And it's getting more and more common now that it's getting hotter. And most of us are wearing loose cotton things that are rather short. Many people are wearing flip-flops. The mail carriers are wearing their shorts. And a lot of us are cooking outdoors. We maybe don't have an official outdoor kitchen, but we figure out a way to take things outdoors and keep the heat out there if we must cook out. People think I'm crazy, but if I go outside to work outside, I try to stay out there. So I become acclimated to the heat gradually throughout the day because it's been getting over 100 degrees in the afternoon here. And I think we have about a week of that still coming. We've had to watch out for different kinds of mosquitoes that are carrying diseases that we're not really accustomed to here, including Zika, dengue fever, and I think chikungunya.
Beverly Willard there from Stockton, California. And that's all from us for now. But of course, there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you'd like to comment on this one, though, or the topics we're covering, do send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Chesney Fawkes-Porter. The producer was David Lewis. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Chris Barrow. And until next time, thanks for listening and goodbye.
When you buy a Tim's coffee on camp day, 100% of the proceeds will help send youth to a multi-year, life-changing experience. Only on July 19th, buy a Tim's coffee and help change youth's lives. Camp day, it ain't-